Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is Stephen Zunis, and he will be speaking on the roots of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
There'll also be designed for people who may not have come to any previous ones, so you're all welcome to come to as many or as few of these as you would like. I thought we'd start off by just real briefly giving us your name and where you're from. And if there's anything, if you're coming here as someone who is totally unfamiliar with Middle Eastern issues but wants to know, or if you've been involved, say, in a Peace and Justice Committee at your church, has been involved with that, or you've traveled there or whatever, but we can try to keep it under, just a very, very short. So why don't we start?
I'm Astrid Kapke from Minneapolis.
Fritz Kapke from Minneapolis, like the Alice Church.
Well, you're interested in
that. Well, we've got a Lutheran church has written a peace policy that we're in the process of arguing over.
I'm Helen Carlson from Spokane, Washington. Janet from Odessa, Washington. I'm very interested in any kind of peace movement.
And Brenda Finiak, both from Issaquah, Washington and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And this one is original to Pittsburgh. I have a friend who has spent probably about 3 years in Palestine, and I've learned a lot from her and would like to learn more about the whole city.
Want to find out your ideas on how this can be resolved and learn more about the history.
I'm Bruce Harrington from Golden Village.
I'm Jan Becker from Bremerton, Washington.
Name, where are you from, and briefly what brings you here?
Tom Stringer from Gloria Day, North Vancouver, BC. First time just learning.
I'm Stephen Zunis from Bainbridge Island, Washington. And this is, well, I consider one of the most fascinating topics there is. I do this for a living, go around and give workshops and write and that kind of thing. I have some brochures about the Institute that people are welcome to. I guess I'd like to, before I begin, I always like to begin these things, these sessions, just a few moments of silent prayer or meditation. I'll join me in that for a moment. Thank you. Thank you for delaying your lunch to come here. I think the Holy Land obviously has very strong emotional attachments for all of us, given where our faith has arisen. And if anyone's actually visited there, there's something very powerful about actually being on the land that where Jesus walked. Very, very powerful. There's debate about whether, this event happened here or there, or, even debate about whether it really happened the way it was described exactly, or, we're familiar with all these kind of debates, but just being there, even if you don't worry about the details too much, can be a very powerful experience. And of course, it's a very powerful spiritual place for the other monotheistic faiths, Judaism and Islam as well. It's also a very beautiful country, and you can understand why people have fought over it for many, many years. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I could talk maybe 20, 25 minutes or so, and then we could open it up for questions or your own sharing. But also feel free to interrupt me at any time if there's something that you don't understand, or something I say that surprises you, or is different than something you've heard before, or something that I think real important that I left out that should be included. Please feel free to interrupt. Before I even begin that, I want to just talk about... oh, by the way, is somebody taping?
What?
Do you know how the tape system works? Are people...
I think from that thing, and then just automatically pick you up.
Oh, okay. Good.
So that's what we
can do. But, there's a... you often hear people, when they look at the Middle East, say, oh, it's so complicated. There are people who can give you, socially conscious people who can tell you in detail about the oppression in Central America, or the anti-apartheid struggle, or the technical details of the nuclear arms race. When it comes to the Middle East, their eyes kind of glaze over. But what I want to try to emphasize at the outset is, like, the Middle East, like any conflict-ridden part of the world, has its own unique characteristics. And there's certain aspects where one needs to be particularly sensitive and aware. But it really isn't that complicated. I think we get too much in this idea that it's complicated. It's disempowering. We get this attitude, oh, let's leave it to the politicians, authority figures, statesmen, that kind of thing. And I think that's a big mistake. Because it's been a mistake when we've left foreign policy and other major things, international relations, in the hands of the generals and diplomats and the like. And I think, as any socially conscious people, we should take it upon ourselves to educate ourselves, to become involved. Because all of us, I believe, have a stake in that part of the world, as we do anywhere in the world where there's violence, where there's injustice. And so don't feel shame if you feel confused, because many people are. But I do hope that today and the other seminars that I'll be leading can be part of a process where you can become more educated and more involved and contributing to peace and reconciliation there. To look at a couple things about the Middle East in general. The area that we now think of as Israel-Palestine, and the broad area known as the Levant, the area where Asia, Europe, and Africa come together, has always been a crossroads of civilization. Major trade routes. Even long before the discovery of oil in that part of the world, a very valuable piece of real estate. It's been subjected to repeated conquests and invasions throughout history. There are certain parts of the area, what's known as a Fertile Crescent, that goes from what's now Iraq and the Tigris and Euphrates Valley up through parts of northern and eastern Syria, through what's now Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, that, despite our stereotypes of the Middle East as desert and camels and that kind of thing, are actually fertile areas, have been for thousands of years, indeed the cradle of civilization. So these are not, so the land is very important to people there. These are not people who just get on their camels and go to another piece of desert. It's a place where there has been ties for many, many generations, many, many centuries. And it's very important. And indeed, basically what the fight over on Israel-Palestine is about land. Two peoples, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, who both have a long-standing historical claim and a very strong emotional attachment to, unfortunately, the same piece of land. And that basically is what it's all about. And there's certainly religious and great power and other areas that issues that get involved. but primarily it's a national struggle. And we had two very strong forms of nationalism. Now, I should mention right now that I'm no great fan of the nation-state system. I see it as a temporal phenomenon. But for better or worse, it's been what people, at least in recent centuries, and this has been, we see this particularly strongly in the so-called Third World, it's been a way where people, the only way many people could find to protect their institutions and their identity from exploitation from the outside. That it's nationalism, there's a fine line between nationalism and as a healthy liberating kind of force, and nationalism as a chauvinistic or militaristic or imperialist force. But particularly for historically oppressed people, nationalism can be definitely be a step forward to protect them from the twin threats of assimilation and annihilation, as well as more subtle forms of exploitation. And what we have here, what makes this the Israeli-Palestinian conflict such a tragedy, is we have two peoples who've historically been oppressed, each seeing the other as their oppressor. And I'll be talking about this some in more detail in my session tomorrow, where I look at Jewish and Muslim perspectives of the conflict. But in a sense, you see Israeli Jews seeing Palestinian Arabs not as historically oppressed people who are searching for their own national identity, but as return of the Cossacks or the Nazis or others who are there to wipe them out. And certainly Palestinians see Zionism, Jewish nationalism, not as a legitimate national liberation movement for oppressed people, but a return of the Crusaders and other imperialist exploiters who've taken them over. And the actions by both sides have in many ways, more often than not, reinforced the negative stereotypes rather than reassured the other. But Zionism grew out, Jewish nationalism grew out of perceived need by mostly European Jews that there needed to be a national homeland for Jews. That anti-Semitism seemed to rise in cycles, that Jews were never quite safe, never quite trusted, that there was a need where Jews could be both safe from physical persecution, but also have a renaissance of their own cultural, religious, and other forms of identity. And so there's a move among some Jews starting around the turn of the century to go to Palestine, which has long been a dream during the Passover Seder for centuries. It had ended with the phrase, next year in Jerusalem, is a dream of return, had been an integral part of the Jewish faith. Some saw it as more of a symbolic rather than a literal goal, but and indeed Zionism is very controversial among many Jews who thought this was kind of reactionary, the idea of abandoning, that instead of continuing to contribute to social change and progress in other countries, as Jews had done to a disproportionate degree, to sort of go off and ghettoize themselves would not be a good idea. But the Holocaust, of course, vindicated in the minds of the 95% of world Jewry that indeed a nation state was necessary. But in this migration to Palestine, they ran into an intractable problem, and that was that it was already inhabited. And many of these people, many of them were idealistic, many of them subscribed to some very democratic socialist ideals, many of them created some very exciting progressive institutions, the kibbutz movement and others. Many of them came with a very arrogant, indeed racist, kind of attitude towards the indigenous population. And in the years that grew up to Israeli independence, more and more of the land that traditionally been Palestinian was taken by these new Jewish, European Jewish immigrants. Historically, the Zionists said, we bought the land fair and square, and the Palestinians historically said, no, they took the land and threw us off. Both, in fact, are correct, in that in the vast majority of cases, the Zionists did indeed purchase the land, but often it was from absentee landlords, and the Palestinians who'd been living on the land for many generations, even though it was technically in the ownership of somebody else, suddenly found themselves the new landlord who said, get out. And so resentment stirred, and while there had been a small Jewish Palestinian population, which, like the Christian Palestinians, had lived in relative harmony with the Muslim majority. This Zionist movement created more and more resentment. In the early days, there was actually a fair amount of cooperation, even some intermarriage and the like, but as it became clear that the goal was not was an eventual state, and the rights of the Palestinians, the indigenous Palestinian population, might be compromised in the process, more and more resentment flared, and there were intercommunal riots and some very nasty situations, especially in the late 20s and 30s and beyond.
Can I go back with a question? The post-World War I and the Balfour Declaration, mm-hmm. How did Balfour assume that he had a right to the land?
Balfour was a British diplomat who first went in, made official that the British government looked favorably with the idea of the establishment of a Jewish commonwealth in Palestine. And in many ways, he didn't have that right. For one thing, Palestine wasn't part of Britain at the time. It was still part of the Ottoman Empire. It was still Turkish. Another thing was that simultaneously, T.E. Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, had simultaneously promised the land to the Arabs. So in many ways, we were talking about a twice-promised land. There was one thing that in the Balfour Declaration a lot of people don't quote. It comes right after the quote I said about looking upon favorably. It said, as long as the rights of the indigenous population are respected, and the non-Jewish inhabitants are respected. So there's a serious question, whether there's any, in fact, in my opinion, there's no question that there was no legal basis for that declaration, but indeed that was the real motivator, that this would not just be a place where Jews could go, but in fact establish from some kind of entity, presumably a state, in that part of the world.
Well, wasn't the so-called purchase of the land through the British because of the Balfour Declaration?
Yeah, well, the British, both sides accused the other of favoritism, helping the other's design. And I think the British were initially very favorable in supporting the Jews, and in large part to help have European Jewry support them in World War I initially. And also to that perhaps these, presumably pro-British as a result of this, European immigrants could sort of keep an eye on that part of the world and look after British interests. Which is why in many Arab eyes they see Zionism as a colonial settler kind of movement, an imperialist kind of movement, looking out for Western interests. And here, after years of Turkish occupation and several decades of European occupation, here the Arabs were finally had this great reawakening of Arab nationalism, only to have what they see as usurping neocolonial influence, come in the heart of the Arab homeland, Palestine. And there's been a long, that's why you have this long-standing viewpoint in the Arab world, that they see Zionism essentially a Western imperialist plot. And many Zionists quite willingly played along with just that. I mean, there are many other Zionists who were more progressive and wanted to see cooperation with their Semitic brethren. So not all Zionists were of this orientation, but for all intents and purposes, in many ways, that's how it played itself out. And indeed, as in many places, like the Indian subcontinent and elsewhere, when the British left, they left a big mess in their hands and people killing each other in great numbers. And the United Nations decided, in this kind of Solomon-esque solution in 1947, to partition Palestine in half. Half would go to the Jews for a Jewish state, half would go to the Arabs for a Palestinian state, and Jerusalem and its environs would be UN administered by the United Nations as an international city. There are those, some on both sides supported, some on both sides rejected. The Arabs were particularly angry, though, because the Jews only controlled 6% of Palestine at that time, and they were given half of it. including areas that had vast, large majority of Arab population. And also, again, it's for reasons that prompted your question, which I elaborated some on, they again saw this as a colonialist outpost, which they refused to recognize. So the intercommunal violence increased. There were massacres on both sides. And the Jewish community, which was much more organized militarily, politically, and otherwise, administratively and otherwise, gained the upper hand. Now, there's long been historic, and the violence and massacres increased, and the former war broke out in May of 1948 when Israel formally declared its independence. There's been a long historical debate about why, and I should say, in the course of the war, Israel went well, not only defended the 50% of the land that the UN granted them in the face of attacks by neighboring Arab states, but also expanded that to 80% of the Palestinian mandate, including over half of the area that had been granted to the Palestinian Arabs for their state. And Jerusalem, rather than becoming an international city, was cut right down the middle, with the Israeli army on one half and the Jordanian army on the other. Indeed, the Jordanians ended up seizing what remained the Arab part of central Palestine that we now know as the West Bank, and the Egyptian army held on to a narrow coastal area in the western end of Palestine on the Mediterranean that we now know as the Gaza Strip. And Jordan annexed the West Bank, and Egypt assumed administration of the Gaza Strip, so the Palestinians never got their state, as they were promised. There's been a long historic, and I should mention the process, that the majority of the Palestinian population of that 80% that was taken over by the newly created State of Israel fled into these neighboring Arab-controlled areas in Lebanon, Syria, West Bank, Jordan proper, Gaza Strip, Egypt, and beyond. And there's been long historical debate about why the Palestinians left. The Israeli line traditionally was that they left of their own free will, or their leader said, get out of here, we'll kill the Jews and come back and take up the spoils. The Arab version was that they were forced against their will as part of a very conscious, deliberate policy of ethnic cleansing by the conquering Israeli forces. More objective observers a long time took more middle ground. They fled the reasons that most refugees fled, that is to get out of the way of the fighting. And furthermore, though indeed the Israelis did do some calculated efforts, like there was a massacre of a Christian Arab village known as Deir Yassin on Good Friday of 1947, where virtually the entire population, 350 or more people, mostly women and children, were massacred and stuffed in a well. And the sound trucks and leaflets went to other villages saying, this is going to happen to you too if you don't clear out, which helped encourage the exodus. Interestingly, recent archival stuff from Israeli sources that have come out just in the past few years have largely confirmed the Arab version of events. That indeed was a very conscious and deliberate policy of ethnic cleansing to make it a purely Jewish area. They weren't totally successful, especially up in the Galilee region in northern Israel. There's still a largely Arab population. Nazareth, the hometown of Jesus, is in Israel proper, but it's predominantly Arab city. And there are quite a number of other Arab villages up in the Galilee region. And after, I won't go into in details about subsequent wars, except that in 1967, Israel also took over the West Bank and Gaza and parts of neighboring Arab states as well. And they remain in occupation of most of those territories to this day. Under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians found themselves under an effective martial law situation. Most political freedoms, indeed until very recently, even things such as waving a Palestinian flag or displaying a Palestinian flag or wearing Palestinian colors or singing national songs or anything of that nature was subjected to some rather severe sanctions. There have been as many as 10,000 political prisoners, large numbers for nonviolent offenses. There's widespread torture in Israeli prisons on a systematic basis of Palestinian prisoners. Their land confiscations are widespread. They are generally turned over to colonists from Israel who set up settlements with heavy government subsidies in this area. All of this, incidentally, is illegal by international law and has been subjected to repeated United Nations Security Council resolutions, which Israel has up to this point chosen to ignore. The situation for Palestinians in Israel, they are somewhat better. They are citizens. They do have the right to vote and some more political freedoms, but they are very much second-class citizens. They still are subjected to sometimes arbitrary arrest and imprisonment, and can have their land confiscated fairly easily without much in the way of legal recourse. The situation of Palestinians in exile is not much better. Palestinians, with the exception of Jordan, have been refused citizenship in most cases, and in Jordan, even where there is citizenship, have been seen with great suspicion by the Jordanian authorities and the monarchy. Indeed, as many as 8,000 Palestinian civilians were massacred in 1970-71 by Jordanian authorities, and there have been large-scale massacres in Lebanon as well, and there were smaller-scale massacres in Kuwait and other Gulf areas in the aftermath of the Gulf War just a few years ago. What's striking about the situation is, in many ways, how it parallels the Jewish experience. The Palestinians, like the Jews, are in a diaspora, are in exile, where they have, because of their traditionally higher level education, taking on disproportionate positions in academia, in the arts, in business, and elsewhere, and as a result have been subjected to scapegoating and discrimination. And just as this history of scapegoating and discrimination have led many people to argue, and I think correctly, that Israel must exist, the Jews must have a homeland of their own to turn to, so I think we can similarly argue the Palestinians also have a right of a national homeland as well. And yet now you have an irony that an American Jew, middle class and fairly safe and that kind of thing, can move into a home that belonged to a Palestinian through this right of return, this automatic citizenship and subsidies and everything that comes to any immigrant, while as a Palestinian who grew up in that house is not allowed back. And obviously has led to great resentment. And the Palestinians were the sense they had been abandoned by the world. And the Arab armies and wars against Israel had only made the matters worse. And so by the late 60s, the Palestinians took it on through the Palestinian Liberation Organization, an entity which they wanted to struggle for their own liberation from occupation. This is a time where there's a lot of rather romantic and unrealistic notions about Third World Revolution and the primacy of armed struggle in that revolution. And given that this was not a foreign conquering foreign army like the Portuguese in Africa or the United States in Vietnam or whatever, this was a people who felt, Jews, Israelis, who felt like they'd returned to their homeland, it wasn't the kind of thing that a protracted guerrilla war could really be successful in at doing. And so in many cases, the Palestinians turned to terror, hijacking airliners, taking over embassies, seizing hostages. Hundreds of Israeli civilians and other foreign nationals were killed as a result of attacks. And rather than weakening the resolve of the Israelis, like in most cases of terrorism, it only hardened their resolve. Indeed, especially for people like Jews with their history who feel that the whole world's out to destroy them anyway, this only reinforced this hardlined attitude. Indeed, the Israelis ended up killing many, many times more Arab civilians in their retaliatory airstrikes and against Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan and elsewhere. Meanwhile, the Israelis, with huge subsidies from the United States and other Western powers, and having very strong military, and being protected by U.S. veto from any kinds of international sanctions for their illegal activities in the occupied territories, got very strong, cocky, and rather arrogant, and by the late 70s, elected for the first time a far right-wing government under the leadership of Menachem Begin, who himself had been a terrorist during the Israeli War of Independence against the British, and led any and essentially eliminated any pretense of the more social democratic, the previous social democratic Israeli government's commitment to peace and reconciliation. And the repression increased all the more, and military aid and military cooperation in the United States increased even more. And in many ways it looked, and ironically they were able to take advantage of other changes in Israeli society. Because even though the Zionist movement was originally a European phenomenon, the majority of Israeli Jews by this time were actually of non-European origin. These were Jews who lived in North Africa, elsewhere in the Middle East, and beyond, who had come when, after the establishment of Israel, we saw for really the first time, in any systematic way, large-scale persecution of Jews in Arab countries. So here came people who were very mad at their at Arabs for how they'd been treated in Arab countries, who felt they were passed over by these European immigrants, or the Europeans who dominated the Israeli society. And in many ways, the phenomenon you see a lot of with white working class people here in the United States, wanting somebody to feel better than, and rather than going shifting their politics to the left to work for economic justice, being treated not well in Israeli society, instead shifted to the right to support the more hardline, very racist and reactionary forces in Israel. So you had this tragic situation going well into the 1980s that seemed seemed intractable. But some big shift happened in the late 1980s with the rise of what's known as the Intifada, which is the Arabic word for shaking off. It was a popular grassroots movement by the Arabs, by the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for national independence. This had been inspired somewhat by the Palestinians realizing more and more that they could not wipe Israel off the map. They could not pretend it wasn't there, but they had to work with Israel. That they, instead of having a democratic, secular Palestine, Arab-dominated, presumably, Palestine, and all of that area, they had to settle for something less, like 23%, as a state in the West Bank and Gaza. But ironically, because the Israeli, so even while the Palestinian movement was getting more and more moderate, the PLO was getting more and more moderate, they stopped doing terrorism, you know, by the late 70s, at least the mainstream of the PLO, the Israelis were simultaneously moving in the opposite direction, getting more hardline, less like compromise. And the United States seemed to be encouraging the most hardline elements in the Israeli government. And I'll be talking some about that when I talk about the U.S. role on Friday, my Friday seminar. But so simultaneously, the idea that there could be a West Bank Palestinian state, and that would be the Palestinian state, and they'd have to work with Israel, be in peace with Israel. And still the Israelis and the Americans took the line, no, you can't even have 23% of Palestine, you can't have any state of your own. The Palestinians in the occupied territories decided, we've got to take it on our own. So they started this massive resistance. And despite the images we get of stone throwing used and the like, the bulk of the Intifada was nonviolent. In many ways, it was classic Gandhian kind of tactics. General strikes, boycotts, peaceful demonstrations, civil disobedience, tax refusal. Very impressive forms of resistance, which were met by quite brutal repression. But you saw a growing Israeli peace movement. Indeed, many Israelis who would refuse to serve in the occupied territories, these weren't pacifists, and they were willing to serve in the Israeli army to defend the borders, but not to be an occupier of another people, not to serve outside the internationally recognized borders of Israel. You saw a lot of changes in public opinion around the world. Traditionally, many people were traditionally sympathetic with Israel because of their invasion of Lebanon and the tens of thousands of civilian casualties there, along with the repression against a largely nonviolent uprising in the occupied territories. More and more people, you know, started believing that the Israeli David was looking a lot more like the Philistine Goliath. And it became pretty clear there needed to be some kind of compromise. And indeed, the Israelis voted for the Labor government, the more moderate social democratic government, back into power in an election just two years ago. But the problem was the U.S. was running the peace process, the peace talks, and the U.S. position was that the PLO, which virtually every Palestinian saw as its government, the U.S. refused to allow the PLO to take part in the peace process. So they were stalemated as a result. So the U.S., so the Israelis decided the only way they could make progress was to meet secretly with the PLO in a third country, Norway. And the Oslo Accords came into being, which are, well, very vague in many respects, and I'll be talking about these in a lot more detail on tomorrow when I look at Wednesday when I look at prospects for peace. Do allow some degree of Palestinian autonomy. Palestinians see this as a first step toward, in fact, most of the world sees this as a first step towards Palestinian statehood, but at this point, the United States and Israel affirm that it will be far more limited than that. Indeed, bear striking resemblance to the former South African Bantustans, where there is, you know, not much in a way of real autonomy or true independence, but just enough to control a few domestic affairs, but far short of the statehood which many people believe that the Palestinians deserve. And that's sort of, in a nutshell, the underlying issues. And I'll be looking in the coming week about some of these aspects in more detail, but right now I just want to throw it wide open if people are interested in the historical aspects, or if you're not going to make it to some of the subsequent forums, if there are any specific angles of the current situation that you'd like to see addressed.
Well, don't the Palestinians now have self-government in the Gaza Strip?
Yes, to an extent, except that as much as a third of the Gaza Strip is still controlled by Israeli settlers. The Israelis can intervene militarily at any time of their pleasing. They can veto or overrule any law that's passed by the self-governing council, and a whole number of other areas that are quite limiting. Obviously, they can't do anything in ways of foreign affairs. They still have to use Israeli currency, so they're tied economically. So again, it's a very limited form of autonomy. But for the people of Gaza, I mean, to at least not have, you know, the Israeli boot on their neck, you know, that they can fly their flag without getting shot at. You know, they can, they're Palestinian police instead of a foreign occupying army. I mean, that's no small potatoes, and they're certainly grateful for that and happy for that. But again, it's still pretty limited.
Do you see any peace until these Israeli settlers leave? There's that movement to get them to leave.
Yes. The international law says very clearly you cannot resettle your population on territories seized by military force. The Israelis have ignored that, and the U.S. keeps subsidizing the settlers. Most settlers are there just because the government gives them subsidies, because they want to create demographic realities on the ground like that to prevent any kind of real autonomy or statehood. and some are more very hardline ideological or indeed messianic kinds of reasons there. And many of these are very violent people, and are issued armed. In many ways, their rule parallels that of the death squads in Central America. They are armed and trained by the Israeli government. They're essentially given vigilante powers. And the government says, oh, it's just the extreme right wing, and we have extremists on the other side, we're doing our best to, in many ways, Rabin is a Duarte. Those of you who are familiar with the history of El Salvador, certainly being more moderate than many people, but at the same time, not really doing anything to crack down on what are essentially death squads. And I think that necessarily has to be addressed. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're all kicked out. There could be some compromise that they become, Jewish citizens of Palestine. Or they could be expatriate Israelis living in Palestine, subjected to Palestinian laws, like an expatriate living in any other country. But, of course, these settlers want nothing of that. They want to rule it all themselves, and again, they are and are willing to use extreme forms of violence to try to maintain those privileges. I mean, just for an example, if you that will be an Israeli settlement that will be large and spacious and beautiful houses and swimming pools and everything like that next to a Palestinian village. They get massive subsidies from the Israeli government to expand and build and do everything, where they deny permits to, Palestinian villagers to even add an addition to their house or to drill a well. If they drill, the settlers drill a well up the water table and dry out the Palestinian well, then they won't give the Palestinians a permit to dig another one. And then at night the settlers will come rampaging in and shoot into houses. I mean, it's like the Klan used to do with impunity in the U.S. South, in black neighborhoods, and no real response. As I said, it's a very destabilizing, dangerous situation. Now, there have been a number of proposals to tie U.S. aid to Israel to curbing settlers, but the U.S. has the Clinton administration has ruled that out, and the U.S. has vetoed or threatened to veto any U.N. resolution which calls for enforcing the already existing resolutions about ending the settlement activity.
So how do you explain the American foreign policy on this thing? There's still bias in favor.
Yeah, I wouldn't say as much bias in favor of Israel, because I think ultimately it hurts Israel, because because it's just making Israel more isolated and dependent on the United States. Indeed, it defeats the whole purpose of Zionism, which was to become non-aligned and independent. I think basically the U.S. supports Israel and opposes the Palestinians the same way the U.S. has supported any right-wing, militarized, pro-Western regime and opposes any radical third-world nationalist popular movement. In many ways, and I don't want to oversimplify this to make it sound conspiratorial, but if you look at what role Israel plays in the United States, Israel has kept radical nationalist movements, not just among the Palestinians, but in Yemen and Jordan and Lebanon and Shaq, they kept them down. They were a counter to what were pro-Soviet regimes like Syria. They funneled U.S. arms to third parties. The U.S. couldn't arm directly for political reasons, like South Africa, Guatemala, Iran, the Contras. They sent advisors to, El Salvador and South Africa and other places around the world to prop up pro-Western states. Their Air Force is predominant in the region. They've been testing ground for new American weapons. The Mossad, their secret police, have worked with the CIA in intelligence gathering, covert operations. Their military-industrial complex and ours have collaborated very closely on everything from anti-missile defense systems to new jet fighters to even Star Wars research. So I see it mostly as a strategic thing. What's ironic about this is if you look at the history of Jewish oppression, what would happen was that the ruling elites in a given country had sort of set up the Jews to be the visible agents of the oppressive order, to be the moneylenders, the tax collectors, the managerial class or whatever. Not the people who really had the power, but sort of the more visible lower rung of power, so that when people would get resentful at economic injustice, the ruling elites could say, hey, it's not us, it's the Jews. People would turn on the Jews and held up the pogroms and the repression, the Jews would flee into another country, the whole cycle would start all over again. And the whole idea of Zionism, when if Jews could have their own nation state, they'd no longer be dependent on the whims of the ruling class of any given country for their survival. What has happened, the tragic irony, this cycle has been perpetuated on a global scale. Like those of you who remember the Suez Crisis in 56, when the British and French wanted to get rid of Nasser in Egypt, they sent in the Israelis. And similar in ways I just described, the United States is using Israel for the same purposes. So then you have these you hear these reactionary third world regimes saying, "Oh, Zionism is the cause of all your problems," rather than looking at the real injustice, which is the international economic system, which is Western dominated system, which is exploited to them. Once again, the Jews are being used as scapegoats. So here you have the Western powers seeing these Semitic peoples fighting out against each other. Well, we sell arms to both sides, you know. And again, I don't want to oversimplify this as some kind of grand conspiratorial thing, but this is in effect, this is old-fashioned divide and rule, kind of thing. And personally, I don't think Israel will really be safe until it sees its interests ultimately as a third world country. Because remember, a majority of Jews are third world people. These are Sephardim. These are can you imagine what the Middle East would be like if you had Israeli technology, Palestinian industriousness, and Arabian oil wealth combined? That might not be great for the oil companies or the Pentagon or the arms manufacturers, but you know, I think it'd be great for the Middle East. And so, in many ways, again, consciously or unconsciously, we have a very short-sighted, militaristic kind of policy. And then the other irony in all this is when people complain to politicians or raise these issues here in the United States, we'll often be told, hey, look, we understand, but the Jewish lobby, they're so powerful. In other words, the wealthy politicians and people who really have the power in this country to direct foreign policy are not really responsible. They're really these rich Jews behind the scenes manipulating things. Again, falls back to the old anti-Semitic stereotypes. Because even people in the peace movement and human rights activists and churches, will tend to blame the Jewish lobby. And indeed, it is a very powerful, well-organized force. I don't want to minimize the role, but at the same time, it's often exaggerated, and it gets a lot of people off the hook that shouldn't be, and again, falls into a lot of classic anti-Semitic kinds of stereotyping. But I think it's important to look at the bigger picture, because frankly, I don't think U.S. foreign policy is that pluralistic. That any one lobbying group, even a well-organized one, has that kind of power. I think it's out of any kind of great moral commitment to Israel either. I mean, we've never been very moral in our foreign policy. Anywhere. And again, if we were really concerned about Israel's survival, we would have given most arms to Israel in its first 20 years of existence, when its democratic institutions were strongest and it was most vulnerable militarily. Instead, the more repressive Israel's become and the stronger it's become militarily, the more arms we've sent. And it's never paralleled any real security threat. It's always paralleled U.S. strategic interests and that part of the world and the third world in general. So I think that's really what's underlying this bias.
What role do the children play, and how does that affect the future?
Palestinian children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a great story about a 10-year-old who was caught throwing stones at an Israeli jeep, and he was dragged down and by these big burly Israeli soldiers, and the light shining on him and threatening him and everything he told, who put you up to this, and finally burst into tears and said it was his his brother Muhammad that had put him up to this, and he went down, he kicked in the door and said, call for Muhammad to come out, and back came his four-year-old. but you know, it was like in many ways, the older generation was either in jail or disillusioned or just struggling to survive economically because the Israeli occupation had totally dismembered, you know, almost any autonomous economic institutions the Palestinians had once had. So in many ways, it was up to the, 12 to 17-year-olds, sometimes even younger, to go out and I mean, it's kind of like what happened similarly in the townships of South Africa in the mid-80s, where people said, we have nothing to lose. You know, they bare their chest and say, go ahead, kill me, you know. What? There's nothing, you know, nothing more to lose. And sometimes they get killed for doing that. But there was this shift, which I think which happens in the many proto-revolutionary situations, where people just finally decide they've had enough and they're willing to risk all and are willing to do it. And here are these Israeli soldiers, you know, saying, my God, we're killing children, you know. And it really had, I mean, a lot of Israelis and Jews around the world really had to look inwardly, and a lot of their many, many previous assumptions had to seriously be re-examined. Now, another aspect of the Intifada, which maybe, and I'll talk about this again on Wednesday when I look at the peace process in some detail. Another part of the Intifada was not just the throwing stones or the, you know, nonviolent resistance, but the creation of alternative autonomous institutions, popular committees that would have certain medical services and the like, and other kinds of aid. People started growing gardens, women started sewing their clothes again to divorce them from the economic integration that Israel had tried to impose over the years since 1967. And the Israelis saw this as a much more threat than kids throwing stones. I mean, you could go to jail for 5 years for being part of a gardening committee. You know, because they saw indeed that this was a bigger threat, because this was the proto-state that was forming. And these were done in very grassroots democratic fashion, much under the leadership of women, because so many of the men were in jail or wanted or whatever. So in many ways, this is not just a struggle for independence against Israel, but also a social revolution in a fairly conservative, almost feudalistic society. And so a lot of people were concerned with the Oslo Accord was that Arafat and his guys who've been in exile are sort of going to impose their order and sort of usurp these grassroots institutions that a younger generation had formed. And Mandela didn't make, I mean, initially when the ANC people came back in South Africa, they started to do this, and the people said, hey, wait a minute, guys, you know, we've been doing all this in the township all these years. And when Mandela got out of prison, he essentially sided with the grassroots over the old guard. Unfortunately, Arafat has gone in the other direction. He's pretty much tried to impose things, the old guard. And so there may be some intention within the Palestinian community of whether these autonomous democratic institutions will be able to survive, or will they essentially be taken over by a more autocratic form from the old nationalist leadership.
Geographically, how large is the Gaza Strip, and isn't it just almost an arid place, or not?
Well, there traditionally it's fairly dry, but there's some irrigation. There are orange orchards and olive groves, and so there is some agriculture. It's a very nice port. It was closed down for all those years from the Israelis. In fact, it was a very prosperous town at one point, but since the occupation, it's been just incredible poverty. Mm-hmm. Just. It's also very crowded. I mean, 500 people per square mile, kind of thing. Just as enormously overpopulated. It's fairly tiny, and up to a third of it is even though the total population is 800,000, a third of it's reserved for only 5,000 Israeli settlers.
But won't there be these the people that went into Lebanon, you know, and fled, won't they be coming back?
Well, Gaza is also the West Bank, and according to the Autonomy Agreement, which just includes Jericho right now, will expand to the rest of the rest of the West Bank, and and hopefully something will be worked out on Jerusalem, which is technically part of the West Bank, but the Israelis and the United States insisted that not be part of the negotiations right now. An independent, let's assume the best, there is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. It doesn't mean that every Palestinian is going to move back there any more than every Jew decided to go to Israel when it was created. That there will be some resettlement, because a lot of Palestinians are still in refugee camps to this day, but the majority of Palestinian exiles are not in refugee camps at this point. Hopefully there'll be a, especially if there's, you know, aid coming in from other sources, from Europe, United States, Japan, the Arab world states, you know, there can be some resettlement, because it's not, the West Bank's not that crowded. It is a fairly, and if, you know, if people use water fairly responsibly, there's enough water. If all those countries in that part of the world weren't spending so darn much for weapons, there'd be plenty of money for the developing the economic infrastructure. But many people who try to use the excuse that, oh, it's not economically viable, therefore it doesn't have a right to exist. Well, most nation states in the world are not economically viable, but still, you know, people have a right to nationhood, statehood, if that's what they want. And it's clearly what the Palestinians want. And again, they're willing to say, we've given up on getting it all back, so at least give us 23%. And virtually every country in the world supports a two-state solution. Israel within its internationally recognized border, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, and some special status for Jerusalem. Virtually every state in the world. There are a few real hardline holdouts like Libya and Iran and some extremist Islamic movements who still don't recognize Israel. And then on the other extreme, Israel and the United States, which doesn't recognize Palestine. Again, virtually everywhere else there is this consensus. And again, the other irony, the U.S. is the chief mediator, because we're actually one of the extremist states, and indeed the chief bankroller and arms supplier and diplomatic umbrella to the occupier. And I think one of the real risks is because the Oslo Accord is so vague, that it clearly needs to be, because the Palestinians have compromised on, you know, virtually almost everything so far, that there has to be more compromise from the Israeli side, that as long as Israel holds the cards in terms of actually physically occupying the territory, as long as the United States, which is a major diplomatic supporter, is actually in some respects the right of the Israeli government when it comes to the Palestinians, there's probably not going to be much movement. Unless, and this is what I'm going to be addressing in my later talks to some degree, the American public mobilizes around the Middle East like they mobilized around Central America and Southern Africa and other places, and tries to change our government policy.
But isn't there a voice similar to yours in the State Department or whatever is advocating, you know, some of your suggestions? Or a difference in policy or change in policy or whatever?
There have been. Most of them are ex-State Department people, unfortunately. Pardon?
Are you ex-State Department?
Pardon?
Are you ex-State Department?
No. But but there was largely a purge of the so-called Arabists during the Reagan administration. And generally the Clinton, again I'll talk about this more on Friday, but generally the Clinton is to the right of Reagan and Bush on the Middle East. If you look at his appointments to State Department posts dealing with the Middle East, these are it's the equivalent of Reagan's appointments in Central America. So if you look at the think tanks, the previous writings, we're talking about people who were supporters of the Likud government, the previous right-wing government, the right of Rabin. Some of you may have seen my article in the Progressive magazine a couple months where I talked about, again, how the U.S., if anything, Clinton administration is, if anything, to the right of Rabin, the right of the Israeli government when it comes to the Palestinians. Thinks he might be giving away too much. And so we're talking about a... And what's also more disturbing is some of the most liberal people in the Senate. We're talking about the likes of Carol Mosley Braun, Paul Simon, Patty Murray, Tom Harkin, you know, go to Ted Kennedy, look down the who's who of many American liberals. They are similarly very, very hard right-wing when it comes to Israel-Palestine.
Isn't this where the Jewish lobby...
This may be an area where the pro-Israel lobby does have clout, because I believe the...